This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Call this number, 800-462-7413. I'll bet Zorba will answer your question. Along with those calls, Zorba, some interesting research.
Yes, we'll talk about men's skin, and is it more sensitive than women's skin?
My skin.
Hey, guys.
I'm very sensitive.
Macho guy's skin.
I'm a very sensitive.
Is it more
skin
sensitive
guy
than delicate girly skin?
Okay, what else?
Then we're going to talk about sick days in smokers and non-smokers, what it means really for our society, what it means for life. You know, a little bit about smoking, how to get rid of smoking, how to cut it out. 20% of us still smoke cigarettes. I know no one who listens to public radio smokes ever, but there might be
That's
some people
probably
who know.
An overstatement. What's our recipe?
Zesty shrimp with watermelon salsa.
That is intriguing to me, I must say. 800-462-7413. And don't forget, by the way, about our medical myth buster coming up toward the end of the hour. Zorba, a listener with us now in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, guys. How are you?
We're fine. How can we help?
I'm in my mid-30s. In my mid-20s, I started losing hair and receding hairline, different things like that. Tried different products. Have used Rogaine now for 10 years, and it has stopped the fallout. I've tried Propecia, different things like that. I understand there is a new thing out on the market called the laser comb that has just gotten approved through the FDA, and I talked to my regular physician, and she really has had no idea about it, and I was just wondering if Zorba has any idea.
But before he answers, let me ask you, have you seen pictures of Zorba and me?
No.
Oh, well, you should check out how handsome guys can be when they don't have a whole lot of hair on their head. You really do. I mean, you're kind of wasting your time and energy and money on this thing. I mean, as you get older, you're going to look better without hair, right, Zorba?
That's right.
That's what I always say.
That's right, Tom. That's what he always said. That is.
But assuming he looks at us and doesn't agree with my assessment, how about answering his question?
Well, the laser comb, by the way, was approved by the FDA, not as a the way medical devices are approved, not the same way that Propecia and Rogaine are approved. It was approved under the cosmetic arm of the FDA. In other words, it was approved under the same,
the
you bet, the same rules as facial creams are approved, the same rules that lipsticks are approved. The FDA basically regulates cosmetics, hair shampoos, and it regulated the laser comb in that way. So when they say FDA approval, first of all, it's the idea that you have the panache of the FDA. If it's approved, it must really work.
Does that kind of mean we'll do no harm? Am I getting this from
that? Well, you know,
is that what that approval implies?
It should mean it will do no harm. It really means something. It really is almost a cosmetics are approved in the same realm. Yeah. The idea is that it won't do harm, but you don't have to prove that it'll do no harm. In other words,
but it doesn't say it's going to help you in any way,
right,
shape,
by no means at all. And if you look at the laser comb, it really fits in the same realm of making what hair you have fluffier. And the idea is that it will add width to the hair so that the hair will look fluffier. In the same way that a hair dryer makes the hair fluff up in the same way, and that's kind of the mechanism that it works. It works in that same heat type way to take the hair that you have and make it a little bit thicker. But I think they're rather expensive. Have you looked into them? What do they cost?
They range from $500 to $600.
Right, from $500 to $600.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about a $5 hair dryer or a $50 hair dryer. It is 10 times more expensive.
Yeah, but it lasts for a long time, I'm assuming. So if it does anything, you can keep using
it year after year after year.
Well, the warranty only says it's covered under just for 1 year.
You see, so Tom, so it doesn't last forever and of course, if you go look at their website, which I'm sure you have, it shows people, you know, initially they look like they're bald and then balder, and then they look like they have thicker hair.
Correct.
Yeah, you can never, ever, ever trust those pictures. First of all, they may be doctored. It's a no pun intended.
Yeah.
Or it may simply be that they looked at the angle and it looks differently. I don't think I would spend my $500 on this. There's no evidence it actually will make the hair. It is a cosmetic issue. It may make the hair look better, but it's a lot of money to spend on something like that. And unless you can be sure that it's actually going to work, I think that's big bucks. Now, if it says that it's guaranteed and you can return it for no cost once you get it, but if it says, for instance, once you use it, it's yours, that's a different issue. Because if you pay by credit card and you get it and it's not what you expect to get and you can return it, you just call your credit card company and say, I'm sending it back. And then you send it back. That kind of a device, I think, is okay. But not a device which just says, I'm sorry, once you open the package, it's yours, forget it. It's too much money.
The alternative is to check our website and really look at a picture of Zorba. And you're going to change your mind. You're not going to want to lose any of that.
That's what Tom is keen for. Good luck.
Thanks for calling 800-462-7413. We welcome a listener now, Zorba, in Winfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure. Thank you for calling. What's up?
I have an ACL reconstruction in the works, and I'm told it's to be an allograft. And I wanted to get Zorba's take on risk involved. I realize it's fairly small, but right on schedule, NPR ran a news story on this a while back, and they did bring up some possible questions of concern. And mostly I wanted to get his take on risks and ask if it was his ACL being reconstructed, would he be comfortable with an allograft? And if so, once it's done, is there a time frame after which it would be prudent to be tested for to make sure my HIV status is still negative?
Yeah. And before you answer his question, what is he talking about?
Tell me what the doctor told you about the allografts.
I don't know what an allograft is.
The allograft is tissue and bone taken from a cadaver to replace the ACL.
Right. So you're talking about the cadaver graft. And the story I think you talked about that I also listened to had to do with the fact of how they are sterilized or not sterilized. There was a big NPR story about how some of the cadaver grafts are basically not sterilized. And so they don't go through a sterilization process. And what does that mean? And whether or not there were a number of orthopedic surgeons that didn't even know, they assumed because it came in a container and it was in liquid that this indeed had gone through a sterilization procedure. And by the way, sterilization of these things, it's not as if it's a simple method that no one is going through. It's that once you sterilize things, you can't do it by heat because obviously you would then destroy the graft. Mm-hmm. And when you add a chemical to it, you may destroy essentially how the graft is going to, how the structure is going to be there because these are not benign, procedures. And so, you know, the question is whether or not they, you know, whether or not essentially that's they're going to be useful or not useful. And like you said, is my HIV status changed on this at all? I don't know if there's been any HIV data on this.
No one, of course, would knowingly have a transplant from a HIV positive.
Oh, of course not.
The question is someone who doesn't, the cadaver when alive didn't know or what.
Well, the issue is where do they get the cadaver grants from? If you have known HIV, they don't ever use, of course, cadaver material for anyone with known HIV. There are people who die of heart attacks and other things who may not know they have HIV and what tests they go through before they actually take the grafts, I have no idea at all.
What do you recommend to our call?
Well, I think these cadaver grafts are being used. They're being used all the time. And if it's worthwhile, I guess I'm not that concerned. And the reason why I'm not concerned is even after this story, I never saw any information in there that showed that hepatitis B and other disease has actually been spread by these cadaver grafts. So if it was recommended for me and I looked at it, it was certainly something I would think about. So did your orthopedic surgeon look at essentially fixing the injury, or did they say that you really need to have a graft? Why the graft versus a simpler repair?
Well, that's been a little bit of a sticking point too. Communication hasn't been real forthcoming.
Communication between you and the orthopod?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He's very good at what he does. Everyone I've spoken to said, you know, when I mentioned his name, they said, oh, you're in good hands. He'll fix you right. He's supposed to be one of the best around.
Yes.
I think the problem is this is just so routine to him that,
Yeah, but I've got a very specific recommendation. You need a second opinion. you need to have somebody else look at you who is at least 100 miles away. That's what I recommend, not somebody who's in town who knows the orthopod who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You need another orthopedic surgeon to talk to. You need to then sit down with another orthopedic surgeon who speaks English in your ear and communicate to determine whether or not you're going to have this done or not have this done. There are too many questions that you have. I would not go through anyone other than a doctor who does the procedure. I think you may decide to go with this, but frankly, you've got lots of unanswered questions. You went into this doctor. This doctor did not give you enough time or energy for you to be able to assure. And if something goes wrong, you are going to kick yourself and say, why didn't I ask more questions? And that's why you're calling. So you need a second opinion. That is my recommendation before you have anything done with
your peace of mind is quite important.
Absolutely.
When you're going into surgery.
Absolutely.
800-462-7413. So, Zorba, my skin might be more sensitive
absolutely.
Than my wife's
absolutely.
Skin.
Absolutely. And the model for finding this out, once again, as our friend are the mice. You know, the mouse.
A mouse
the
study.
Mice. It's
right.
another mouse study. But, I mean, it's well known that men get more skin cancer than women. They get about twice as much basal cell cancer, three times more squamous cell cancers. That's the bad cancer that can actually kill you along with melanoma. And the issue for years has been the fact that men are less likely to protect themselves. They're less likely to wear sunscreen. They're more likely to work outside. They're more likely to take off their shirt and so on.
Risk takers.
Yeah, when it comes to sun,
yeah.
I mean, it's funny. I don't
Other
think
ways
the sun
too.
Is a major risk, yeah. but I think risk takers are just plain dumb. You know, one of the two dumb men. But anyway,
tell us about the study.
They looked at hairless mice. Now, hairless mice have been known to, you know, they keep their shirts off when they're outside working on the mouse traps and going around. But hairless mice are a medical model because they also get skin cancer.
Yeah.
And they took hairless mice, put them under a sun lamp. Yes, mice also like to get tanned before they go south. And they underwent 10-minute tanning. Sessions three times a week.
Now, why are you laughing at this? Serious.
Well, I wonder how much they charge the mice for the tanning sessions.
They put lotion on some of them, and they
didn't put any lotion.
Oh, yeah,
but they
okay.
had male and female mice.
They have little sunglasses, and
I'm sure they have
little drinks.
while they bake. But it turned out that the male mice were twice as likely to get skin cancer as the female mice.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, so the question was, I mean, they're both these are hairless mice. They're essentially ultraviolet light affected males more than females. So it may be that male skin is more sensitive than female skin. Now the question is, what is it within male skin?
I've always thought that male was the more sensitive gender.
Absolutely. I think
whatever the species.
I think this is the first step for the fact that chick flicks will soon be called male flicks, and women will start to go to movies that have lots of violence, lots of sexual overtones, and at least two or three car chase scenes. You've got it, Tom.
It's the beginning
of a movement.
Even if that didn't happen or doesn't happen, I think women are tougher than men in our society.
Well, maybe. And when it comes to sunscreen, Tom, maybe that's the fact.
Be.
Maybe they're much more, you know, their skin is tougher than ours.
800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Dodgeville, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Very good, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, how can we help?
About a year ago, I was at work, and I bent down to a squat to look into a safe, and my pants became a little bit taut on the back of my knee and my thigh,
mm-hmm.
and I felt a burning feeling that went down to my calves, and I heard a ripping noise. And from then on, I couldn't bend my knee anymore.
So the ripping noise was in your leg?
It was in my leg, and then on the side of my knee, on the inside, it became very swollen, also with the back of my knee, and my calf became very swollen. Now, this was a year ago, and I can bend my knee now, but when I squat, I still get a very uncomfortable, tight feeling.
And you didn't go to the doc?
I didn't have insurance at the time, but I did go to the doctor once just to make sure that I didn't have a blood clot.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually just looked at it, at my legs, and felt them, and he thought that I didn't, but he wanted to do more tests. But like I said, I didn't have insurance at the time to cover all those tests.
Mm-hmm. So the test, you had no further testing done. And you're like, so you're on any medications at all, birth control pills or anything else?
No, nothing.
Uh-huh, because birth control pills can cause clots and leg clots. You've got insurance now, or you don't have insurance now?
I don't. I'm self-employed. So
see, that's the whole difficulty here. In order to do to look at clots, and it would be unusual for you to have clots in both legs, you need something called a venous Doppler, and that's a lot of money.
Right.
You know, frankly, all of the whenever you need technology, it costs mm-hmm. a lot. You know, costs a lot of money. And when it comes to payment, if you have insurance, well, they always give discounts to people with insurance. HMOs are 20% to 40% discounted, but people who don't have insurance don't get a discount. I mean, which is really awful. In other words, they're charged full price. Have you done any massage therapy with this at all, or what have you done for this to try to get rid of? It's painful when you squat down, but is it painful otherwise?
It's mostly painful when I squat down. I get that feeling of right about when your limbs are about to fall asleep, that tingling kind of burning feeling, like you need to shake it because it feels like there's going to be pain. I have gotten massages. And the other thing that I forgot to tell you is right after that injury, I got what looked like was cellulite in my calf. And I asked the massage therapist, you know, do you think this is cellulite that's just came on? And she just said, you know, I can't tell you for sure, but it looks like edema. You have swelling in your calf.
Right. So you've got, I'll tell you something. It's possible that you may have some sort of a clotting disorder. It is possible that you may have clots in your leg. If the massage therapist said this looks like it's swelling or edema, you got to go to a doctor and get it checked out. Because there's something that clearly is going on, and the fact is if you need to have medical care, you want to call up and say, look, I don't have any insurance. What sort of a discount is you can give me? I would call around to various clinics, or I'd go to a clinic, you know, that you know may give a discount for people who don't have insurance. But you have to have this looked up, especially if a professional looked at this and said, I think there's swelling going on, you know, because what you're talking about could be due to something significant such as a clot, or something really benign is just what we call venous edema that just happens in the leg that is, you know, that is benign and does not cause a problem.
You don't want to get good luck to you. You don't want to get too political on this program, but we've got to do something in this country.
Oh, absolutely.
Zorba,
well, I mean, you know, this is terrible.
To get people insured somehow.
She does not have insurance, and all of a sudden she goes somewhere, she's stuck with an expensive bill. Now, if you have insurance, you pay a few thousand dollars a year, of course, which you do for your, you know, to pay for your medical care. But the problem is, when she goes and she gets medical care, she is charged first dollar coverage, and that's awful.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in De Pere, Wisconsin. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Okay. I'll give you a little background. Mm-hmm. I have a 20-month-old daughter, and when she was born, when I was pregnant with her, she was 10 days late. And so they were starting to talk induction and stuff like that. So I drank raspberry leaf tea, which I had read works. And she was born, like, a day later. I drank, like, 5 or 6 glasses.
Uh-huh.
So I'm pregnant again, mm-hmm. and our baby is 2 weeks past the ultrasound date this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've drank over 12 glasses of tea and tried various things, and nothing seems to work.
It hasn't done a thing, right?
Yes. And I really am someone who does not want to have, like, hospital-induced labor.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions of things I can do.
Raspberry leaf tea. I love it. You know, first of all, there's no way that we know of inducing an early period besides doing medical intervention with drugs that induce an early period. Producing that delivery. We have drugs to try to soften the cervix, something called prostaglandins. These are gel to try to do that. But frankly, there isn't anything that we... That's your baby?
Yeah, that's the other one.
That we know. The general things, of course, are walking and moving around. You know, these are things that are thought to do it, but the remedies of enemas and hot baths and raspberry leaf teas and all of those, unfortunately, don't really produce this. And if we had a way of doing this in a verified way that was not hospital oriented, you know, and not medically oriented, believe me, that's something that we would do all the time because it's an issue. You're 2 weeks post due. What does your doc want to do, or your family doctor?
I don't know. At my next appointment, I have an ultrasound. I have the nurse-certified midwives, so they're okay. At the hospital, so okay. They're a little more lenient than the
yes,
doctors are.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think I would talk to them about different things that they would recommend, because sometimes there are some things medically. It also is whether your cervix, what your cervix is like, whether or not it's appearing to a face, whether or not it's ripening. These are all words that means that the cervix is getting ready for the baby, you know, that the uterus is getting ready to do the baby. But the fact is, there's nothing that I can recommend. Obviously, the tea was probably coincidental the first time. I hate to say it didn't actually produce the baby, and I'm sure things will work out quite well for you. But I don't have any tricks. There are no tricks of the trade. Bye bye. Is that what your baby's saying?
Well, good luck.
Good luck to you.
And thank you very much for the call. And speaking about a pregnancy, Zorba, we'll check the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a question from Jennifer in Traverse City, Michigan, who writes, I'm 21 years old and had a very nasty bout with toxic shock syndrome last year. Is there any chance that the TSS may have affected my chances of becoming pregnant?
Well, anytime you have any major infection in your body, it can affect fertility. So the answer is yes, toxic shock syndrome, you know, is a very significant disease that can produce problems. However, most people recover from infections and do not have a change in their fertility. So I would assume after any major infection or any major disease that for 1 year post-disease that your fertility may be reduced and affected. But after that, my guess is there probably is not much of an effect on fertility.
Is there any
at all.
Test you can do to check this out?
No, fertility, yeah, try to get pregnant.
Yeah.
That's the best test, try to get pregnant. Unprotected sex for long periods of time generally is the best test to see whether or not you have fertility or not.
Takes a little while. But...
It may take a little while. But on the whole, most people do recover from it. Most women do not have side effects that are lasting. But any major problem often can affect fertility for 6 months to a year after that. A year after that, I think you reach totally the normal, you know, the normal fertility.
So. If you have a question for Zorba, a comment for us, or just a tip for our listeners, then send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up next.
Yes, zesty shrimp with watermelon salsa. What could be wrong with that? It's got shrimp, it's got zest, and it's got watermelon, and it's got salsa. Everything you need.
Lots more of your calls at 800-462-7413, our medical myth buster, and some more research, too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time now, Zorba, and this one sounds good. Looks good, too. We have at least part of the recipe sitting right in front of us for zesty shrimp with watermelon salsa.
Absolutely fabulous, dynamite recipe. You've got zest in there. The word zest is good, right? Versus dull and boring shrimp.
Yeah.
I mean, that recipe would never make it. You have shrimp, which, of course, is one of the gifts that we have, the bounty of the sea that we love. And then we have watermelon. I mean, watermelon is wonderful.
Well, that's a little overstatement.
Well, I
like
watermelon.
Okay.
Watermelon is not used much for cooking because of the water in it. And basically, the water in watermelon tends to leach out. So you've got to make this fresh, because it's one of the issues is that it doesn't keep.
Yeah.
Because watermelon, as soon as you cut it, the water tends to go out. And that's why you often, when you have fruit salads, often watermelon is left out, because the watermelon will begin to sort of leak out of there. So, okay, start out
Wait, but my issue with Adam on this, who put this together, our producer, your recipe, Adam did it.
Yeah.
Here we have the...
we've got the salsa.
We have the salsa, lieu of the shrimp, we have a box of
wheat thins. Now, these are deveined wheat thins, mind you. But I mean, come on, cheap is cheap.
No,
you know, 16 wheat thins do not compare to 16 jumbo shrimp.
We're going to talk about cheap. I mean, you're the chef.
Come on,
you're the chef.
Yeah.
That's and you right. have a yeah, lot more right. money that's than right. Adam, our that's producer,
right. yeah,
has.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
so
yeah.
You, oh, could, you, mean, you I, could. You could.
Hey, wait a minute. You're
this
turning
room.
This on me. I am sorry. I do not accept that. Do not turn that on me. These are within.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Start out with 16 jumbo shrimp peeled and deveined.
16 jumbo shrimp peeled and deveined.
Now, the reality is, you know, you can use a smaller number of cheaper shrimp. You know, the
oh, you don't
the
want
shrimp,
to do that,
the more expensive. But if you're going to do this,
there's
you
a huge taste difference.
Yes, you love. Yeah, you
shrimp.
Love, I know you love shrimp.
I do. I like it, but those little things, forget them.
Yeah, they really don't taste right. nearly as much. 2 cloves of garlic minced.
2 cloves of garlic minced.
1 teaspoon of lemon zest.
Little tea, lemon zest.
2 tablespoonfuls olive oil.
2 big tea olive oil.
Always extra virgin, remember, always extra virgin. I've got my favorite. It's up on our website. I've got my favorite.
Okay.
1/4 cup of orange juice.
1/4 cup of OJ.
1/4 cup of finely chopped cilantro.
1/4 cup finely chopped cilantro.
Now, this is really important. The cilantro, first of all, if you like the taste of cilantro, use it 1/4 cup, finely chop it. Often when we use cilantro, we don't finely chop it. If you don't like the taste of cilantro, and some people don't, no. you can substitute parsley. And parsley, I think, is a wonderful herb that we don't use nearly as much.
Well, parsley
as
tastes
we could.
Good.
It really
I, when
tastes
I get
good.
It on the plate, I have it before right. I give the right. plate up
right.
at a restaurant.
That's
I
exactly
like the parsley.
So finely chopped parsley yeah. will work for this. 1 teaspoon of chili powder.
Little tea chili powder.
That's right. Now, this is chili powder with bite, if you want it. I mean, that's what makes the zest. Remember,
yeah,
this is
yeah.
zesty shrimp yeah. with watermelon salsa. Okay. Now, the salsa stout. Start out with 1 lime.
This is the salsa. 1 lime.
2 cups of watermelon seeded and cut into 1/2-inch pieces. So chunks, you know, pieces.
Two that's cups chunk. Of watermelon seeded cut into 1/2-inch pieces.
That's right. 1 cup of cucumber seeded and cut into 1/2-inch pieces.
Oh,
again,
yeah,
nice little chunks.
In there.
That's right,
that's
chunks.
That's 1 cup of cucumber that's seeded right. cut into 1/2-inch pieces.
Exactly. 1/4 cup of sliced onions. You got your sliced onions.
1/4 cup of sliced green onions.
And if you want them, and they're nice green onions, so they've got that, you know, kind of look to them.
Yeah.
2 tablespoonfuls of fresh cilantro minced. And again, if you want to use parsley, you can use parsley here.
2 big tea of fresh cilantro minced.
That's right. 2 teaspoons of a jalapeno chili seeded and chopped.
2 little tea jalapeno chili seeded and chopped.
Right. Now, here's
chopped.
Where you determine the amount of heat. If you use a habanero, I can never pronounce it, the hotter the chili, and there's a hot range, the hotter this is going to be, and the milder it'll be, and 1 teaspoon of sugar.
A little tea sugar.
That's right. And if you want to add variety to this, you could use
I'm going
a
to taste
teaspoon
while
of
you're
honey. You will taste. Are you
going to
use the wheat thins?
No, thank you on the wheat thins. Yeah.
Okay, for the shrimp, combine the shrimp, garlic, lemon zest, olive oil, orange juice, cilantro, and chili powder in a large freezer bag. You know, a nice little freezer bag. Shake it for 1 minute, get it all around, and then refrigerate it for an hour. So it basically is going to infuse into the shrimp. Then skewer the shrimp, and you either grill them or broil them over medium heat until pink. That's about 2 minutes on each side. Once it turns pink, you're done. Overdone shrimp taste mealy, and what you want to do is you just want to cook them slightly. That's how you do it. It's just barely cooking them. Mm. Now, for the salsa, use a paring knife, remove and peel the white pith from the lime. Cut the lime into 1/4-inch pieces. You're going to want to cut it. Add the lime to the remaining ingredients in a medium bowl. Season with a little salt and pepper. Use kosher salt. It'll taste much better than salt that you normally use, you know, out of the container. And then toss it to blend and cover and refrigerate it for 30 minutes. And you can do it for about 2 hours, mm-hmm. but if you go to like 4 to 6 hours, the water is going to leach out of the watermelon and the cucumber, and you're not going to want to do it then. To serve it, spoon about 1/2 cup of the salsa on a plate. Top it with the shrimp. Bon appetit. It'll be delicious. Now,
this salsa is delicious.
Yeah, the salsa is really
and
good.
And I'm trying to imagine the salsa with the shrimp. Unfortunately, I don't have the shrimp to taste, to see what it would taste
this
like.
Is
but
scrunchy.
When you do it, you're not going to be like Adam. You're going to put the right combination together, and it is delicious, isn't it?
It is really good. Now, one of the issues about this is the salsa really has to be cold in order for it to work well. The shrimp... If you make the shrimp super hot, you take it off the grill and you put the hot shrimp with the cold sauce up, great.
Yeah.
In other words,
it'll cool
have
the shrimp down a little bit.
You bet, but have the people at the table and serve it right on their plates and put the cold salsa on top of it, and you've got a dynamite dish.
Yummy.
Ready for dinner.
If you would like a copy of this recipe, we're happy to send it to you. Address your request to Zorba Pastor and Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. Be sure to enclose a self-addressed business-sized stamped envelope, and we'll send the recipe back to
you. Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can see this recipe, other fine recipes, and sign up for our weekly podcast.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi. How are you all?
We're fine. How can we help you?
Well, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. I often snack on nuts, and I like to do that because they're a great snack. They're full of protein and because they contain healthy fats.
Mm-hmm.
And the nuts that I enjoy most are generally roasted and salted. So my question to you, gentlemen, is during this roasting process, do the fats become denatured and then the health benefits then are lost?
No, not at all, not at all. When you roast them, any the vitamins that are there are often destroyed by roasting. Anything that that is hot tends to destroy vitamins. They don't destroy all the vitamins, but when you cook, for instance, green beans and you heat them up, if you boil them in a can, they have fewer vitamins than if you take them and kind of snack on them, mm-hmm. you know, without cooking them at all. But from an oil point of view, no, the oil stays, you know, stays right there. You don't destroy the oil at all. And it's the omega-3 fatty acids that really appear to be very useful in nuts. And once again, we're talking about nuts like walnuts, cashew nuts, mm-hmm. pistachios. Mm-hmm. Peanuts are a legume. They're really not a nut. So I
and
would
almonds,
highly
recommend. Those are my favorite, almonds.
Almonds are fabulous. You know, they're really a great nut. So, no, they don't destroy things at all. The issue with nuts that we always worry about are, you know, is the salt issue. And it's a matter of, you know, if they're highly salted, you know, they often give us more sodium than we need.
Sure.
But really, nuts are a wonderful, wonderful way to be able to get a healthful food. They tend to be very satisfying to people. And I highly recommend them.
Great.
One of the issues I have is, what do you eat your nuts out of? Do you eat them out of a big container or a small container?
Well, I'm generally on a diet where I count out 15, and I have 15 almonds at a time, but I generally buy in bulk and then, you know, bring a smaller package with me on the go.
But that really is the issue, because I find if I eat them out of a big container, I will consume the container.
Yes,
and so
sir.
It's important for me to eat them out of a small container. So.
That is true.
So good luck. I think nuts are great.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Are nuts in the container that you buy, you know, the mixed nuts you buy in the store, mm-hmm. are they as healthy as the other?
Well, there are the raw nuts tend to be a little bit healthier because they, first of all, if they're in oil, if they're nuts that are produced in oil, they're not as good as dry roasted nuts because you add oil to the process and you don't really
when
need
when you
buy
Planters or one of those, are they in? They're in.
Well, it doesn't matter. They say dry roasted or they say oil.
Okay.
You know, they don't actually say oil. They usually say dry roasted. Dry roasted nuts are better.
Mm-hmm.
Natural nuts are better because they often, if they say natural raw peanuts or natural raw cashews, they often, once again, are roasted in a light way, and they're more likely to preserve the vitamins that are there.
Yes, yeah, you know, I eat a lot of nuts. I eat them out of the can, and I don't.
You have no problem with
control. No, I don't. I take a few, and then I put.
I cannot eat them out of the can. I will consume the can. You know, it's for me. It's sort of like Girl Scout cookies. When Girl Scout cookies come out,
they're hard to
stop.
If I open up
a box, I eat the box, and I have to be careful. In fact, sometimes I'll have a box or two in my car, and I'll find out I'm eating many more cookies than I would normally eat.
I never snack in the car.
You never snack in the car.
I don't snack.
Oh, that's true. You don't snack.
But nuts are part of my meal, as you know. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. To Stevens Point, Wisconsin, we go now. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have a question regarding nuts. I have a 4.5-year-old son that 2 years ago we discovered by accident he is allergic to tree nuts.
Hmm.
So we're very careful about, you know, keeping him away from peanuts, which are not a tree nut, I guess, but almonds, walnuts, everything. My wife and I love to cook, and we love pesto, which contains pine nuts. And we have not exposed him to pesto because we're not sure if a pine nut is in the same grouping of tree nuts or how wide-reaching the tree nut allergies go.
What kind of a reaction did your son have to nuts? Tell me about it.
Well, when he was about 2 years old, I was eating a pack of cashews, and typical 2-year-old wanted to try them, so mm-hmm. I gave him a cashew, worried more about him you know, choking on
chewing it. Absolutely, because cashews to a two-year-old really, I mean, for our listeners out there, you know, we don't give nuts to little kids because they often choke on them, inhale them, and then they can get a pneumonia from them. But nonetheless, so you gave him a cashew.
He chewed the first one and did quite well with it, so I gave him a second one, and probably within 60 seconds, he started throwing up, I could, you know, he started getting swelling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you could see the hives, and so I knew he was having a reaction, a very severe reaction.
So what'd you do?
We took him up to a clinic.
Okay.
And, you know, they told us to, I think they told us to put him on Benadryl right away.
Right. So they gave you some treatment. Tell me, though, now, has he been tested for allergies?
Has he had
any skin testing?
He has been to a large regional medical center, a specialist, and they did the matrix on the back with the various pin pricks, and that's how they determined the level of allergy, indicated he would never outgrow it and could be fatal because of the severity.
I would stay away from all nuts. I would not give your son.
Including the
absolutely 100%, I would not give your son any nuts at all. Zero. No pesto. He doesn't need pesto for life. It's not a basic ingredient. And the answer is no nuts. I would not trust my if this were my child, if he were in my practice, I would say no nuts for the rest of his life unless proven otherwise by an allergist. Mm. That's very important.
Thank you so much for the call.
And it's not that we separate out tree nuts. Nuts generally grow on trees. That's why they're called tree nuts. Legumes, peanuts are legume. They're a plant. But I would not. A situation like this, no nuts at all. Very important.
We appreciate the listener's call. You'd be nuts to turn off the radio right now because we have a lot of good stuff coming up. More research, our medical myth buster.
Yes.
And more of your calls, too. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Want to talk with Zorba? Call 800-462-7413. But now, Zorba, you mentioned research on smokers and sick days.
Yes. You know, the issue with smoking cigarettes is it affects you, it affects the people around you, and what is the effect on health and wellness? And this was an article that came out, looked at the European Union, looked at Sweden, looked at Denmark, looked at Norway, looked at Ireland, and looked to see the number of sick days that smokers take versus non-smokers. I mean, we know it's bad for your health, but how bad is it? And lo and behold, it appears that you take 20 to 25% more sick days if you are a smoker than if you're a non-smoker. And this obviously affects work output and affects, you know.
I don't have any doubt about that, but I mean 25% more if you're only granted seven sick days, or maybe five sick
days. This is Europe. they get more
sick
days.
That's right. They get a month.
This is Europe. They get more sick days.
Yeah.
So a lot of people take sick days in Europe. And the difference.
Okay, so that 25% really is significant then.
Well, it is significant. And the real issue is that with smoking is that there's some issues that are involved with how do you quit. Some people can quit. Some people can't quit. Clearly, it's an addiction. And clearly, for some people, they think it may be in the DNA, that there are certain DNA markers that make it more likely to be addicted to tobacco than less likely to
go
be
away. Really?
Absolutely. So there may be one issue. The other issue is nonconformity. You know, the fact is most of society does not smoke. 20% of the people do smoke in the U.S. You may be more of a high risk taker if you're a smoker. There's an educational component. People with college education are much less likely to smoke than people who are high school.
We have a friend who's trying to kick the habit, and there's a new pill out.
There's a new pill out called Chantix, C-H-A-N-T-I-X, made by Pfizer. I do not own stock in the company. I just want to let people know that. And the chances that you will quit on that pill are roughly 30 to 40%. The chances if I tell you to quit as a doctor are about 5%, maybe 7%, maybe 8%.
Is this pill the thing that makes you kind of nauseous when you smoke if you're taking this?
No, it doesn't make you nauseous, but the pill itself, for some people, it takes them a little time to adjust. Nausea is a common side effect for a few days.
But it makes it unlikely that you get pleasure out of smoking.
The nicotine receptor makes it less likely that you get pleasure out of it. And if you stay on the pill for 3 to 6 months, you're more likely to quit smoking. About 40% quit smoking at about a month. But if you look, a lot of those people go back, roughly 50%. And that's the same with bupropion, the other
drug. You used to smoke. You quit years ago. I used to smoke. I quit a few years ago.
Oh, yeah. I quit back in the 70s.
Do you consider yourself never going back?
Well, I would never go back to smoking, but I still periodically have the desire to smoke, and it just shocks me that here it is. I'll be in my Miata. It's the summer. I'm going down the road. I'm 18 years of age, and I want a cigarette. How dumb can I be? But, of course, I would never think of having one.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Logan, Utah. Hi.
Hello, how are you guys today?
Fine, how can we help?
I'm considering LASIK surgery, and I was wondering what I should be cautious about, the type I need, or anything of that nature.
What's the surgery on? What part of you?
My eyes, LASIK surgery.
Right, LASIK surgery.
Oh, yeah, that would be eyes.
Right.
Absolutely. I should know that.
Absolutely.
I have a little eye problem.
Well, first of all, LASIK surgery is good. I recommend it for people if they want to have it. I was very interesting. I'm on a human subjects committee called an institutional review board, and we were discussing some newer LASIK procedures that have to be under FDA review because they're newer procedures. And one of the board members made a comment where they said, you know, I've noticed that most eye doctors wear glasses and they haven't had LASIK done. And it was kind of an interesting comment, but certainly among the group that's actually doing the surgery, in our group, ophthalmologists, I think, tend not to have laser procedures versus everybody else. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Well, the ophthalmologist who was on the committee said, well, I'm not sure what will happen 20 years down the line. I mean, he wears very thick glasses. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You don't recommend it to people who you obviously do the procedure on. So I always look a little bit askance at it. On the other hand, I have a number of friends, a number of patients who have done LASIK surgery and love it. And I think as long as you go to a good clinic and you have a good ophthalmologist, you will get good service. And that's kind of the issue is there is how do you judge it? Do you go with a low-cost leader? Or do you spend money and you go to somebody who is charging more money, but you're going to get a better evaluation? The equipment on the whole tends to be the same, and the equipment that is used is really the stuff that counts. So, who have you gone to see? One person, two people?
No one yet. I have an eye appointment tomorrow, and I've worn glasses or corrective lenses since I was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm now 27.
Okay, and you want to have it done. How'd you choose which place to go to?
I haven't. I'm going to talk to my eye doctor tomorrow and see if he recommends anywhere. Mm-hmm. I just want some more unbiased opinion, I guess.
I don't know if your eye doctor will be an unbiased opinion. That's rather interesting. Your eye doctor may be biased because they know the person. May not be based on objective science, or they feel that one person is better than another, or one clinic is better than another.
But
to me, I think that is, as you said, Tom, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
You can't go by the ads that are in the newspaper, right?
Right.
You can't go. There's
phone
no.
Book.
You can't go by the phone book. The data that's kept is not very good. So I think asking your ophthalmologist is really a good way to go. You know, who would you recommend? Mm-hmm. Who would you have your LASIK done by? To me, that's a way to go. And I think the procedure is good. It's not for everyone. There's some people who get an evaluation, their cornea is too thin, and they don't recommend LASIK procedure. But I think going with an eye doctor who recommends it, who you trust, that's what I would have done.
Good luck. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But before our next call, Zorba, before it gets too late, let's get to our medical myth buster.
Yes.
Today's myth has to do with the nighttime drink commonly called a nightcap. But will a drink before bed really help you sleep?
No. Absolutely not. Alcohol before you go to sleep is not a great idea.
Makes you a little tired, relaxes you.
Well, it makes you a little tired, then it makes you a little relaxed. But the fact is alcohol starts to interfere with sleep probably 1 or 2 hours after you've actually fallen asleep. And in the middle of the night, it can actually lead to awakening in the middle of the night because it affects REM sleep, and it basically affects REM sleep in an adverse way.
Hmm.
That's what it turns out.
So it helps us. It can help us get to sleep.
I mean,
maybe.
We've all. I don't want to say we've all, but many of us have had alcohol. It makes us tired, and then we fall asleep because we're tired from the alcohol. But the fact is, for other people, it wakes them up in the middle of the night, and they don't realize it's the alcohol that does it. So some folks actually, in the middle of the night, have another drink. Alcohol is a very poor sleeper. It's really a very poor drug to take if you want to go to sleep. If you want something to go to sleep that's over the counter, melatonin is better. And frankly, for a lot of people, just some Benadryl, which is an over-the-counter sleeping aid, it's an antihistamine, is far better than alcohol.
And for a lot more of us, nothing works really as well as we'd like, and we kind of jump from one thing to another.
Absolutely. There's nothing that consistently works for sleep night after night after night for many people. And for people who suffer from insomnia, really, talking to their family doc, sitting down with a primary care physician and saying, look, I want to try some different things to get to sleep, because there are a lot of different things out there
now. Yeah, I've tried most.
It's far better than that nightcap.
I had about 2 hours sleep last night. I'm going to try a shot before I go to bed tonight and see
no,
if I prove you wrong.
No, that's the myth buster. The shot isn't going to work.
Do you have a medical myth? We'll try to bust it or prove it right. Just send it along in an email with the subject titled Myth Buster. Make sure to send it to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Our next caller, Zorba, is in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Zorba.
What's up?
I have a question about abdominal muscles. I have always been a thin person, but periodically I go to the gym and work out with a trainer, and they give me, you know, the abdominal series to do. But invariably, I will grow these kind of, you know, protruding abdominal muscles.
Really?
And I do tend to...
abs of steel.
Yes. Except they...
Me too. I have that same problem. Everybody's commented on it.
Show me those abs. Lift up your shirt. Let me see those abs of steel.
Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
I tend to develop muscle quickly when I work out overall. But in the abdominal area, it's not exactly what I want.
So in other words, as a woman, you do not want to have highly defined abdominal muscles.
I don't want them to be protruding.
Yeah. Right. Right, that's exactly
it. Every time I talk to a trainer, they say, no, it's impossible. If it's impossible that the workout is doing it because, you know, you're on low weight and high rep, and it won't happen. So then I try again, and sure enough, it happens.
Right, and you build up muscle quickly.
Yeah, and it even happened when I took classical voice training lessons because it takes so much abdominal support.
Oh, yeah, you really have to pressure the abs.
Yeah, you have to pressure that. What's your height and what's your weight?
I'm 5'6", and I weigh 130 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Right, so you're a thin person. You don't have much fat on your body at all, correct?
No, not much,
yeah.
No.
And that's really, and it's very interesting, that actually is the issue. The issue when we look at at abs and definition of abs, if we look at males and females and definition of abs, you know, some men have a six-pack, you know, and they have highly defined abs, and it's not just from the abdominal exercises they do, but it's because genetically they have very little fat on their belly. I mean, they work out and they stay thin, but genetically they don't have much fat on their belly, and so their abdominal muscles protrude, as you say. And, you know, you're in that exact spot. I mean, so the way to get rid of the protruding abdominal muscles is to put on 10 to 20 pounds of fat, and then they won't see the abdominal muscles.
You're kidding.
Now, that is quite a way to do it. I can just imagine I called Zorba Pastor on Your Health. He told me to pork on 10 or 20 more pounds, and then the abdominal protrusion will disappear. But, of course, now I've got this waddle neck, you know, and I've got fat all over my body. But that really is the issue. The issue is that you do not have much subcutaneous fat. And because you don't have much in the way of subcutaneous fat, that actually is why your abdominal muscles protrude and are defined. You're a highly muscular person. You can put on, you know, as you said, you can put on muscle right away because they respond very quickly.
And the trainer can't give you a program that will give you what you want with the exercise without doing the damage, or not damage, without putting the getting the abs big.
Right. And
well,
that
I was wondering, you know, it seems like anything that, you know, is like the forward crunching is particularly developing.
Right. So you want to make sure that when you're looking at the exercise that you should that you want to do, you want to choose exercises that are not abdominal exercises, because frankly, you don't want to work those out very much. So forward crunches, you know, other types of activity to build up that muscle is what you want to avoid. But it is a genetic issue. Now, in your family, tell me about your mom and your dad. Are they muscular or not muscular?
My father is. My mom has a very different body than I do. She's much shorter and much more voluptuous.
So you take after your dad.
Yeah, he's very muscular. And my brothers and my nieces, I mean my nephews, are very, very big, muscular people.
Uh-huh. So that's what it is. It is a genetic issue. So instead of having the curves that are prized in Brazil, you have the straightness that is prized in America.
Yeah. I'm very wiry.
Yeah, so that's what you do. Avoid those exercises and get different genes.
Yeah, thanks for calling
Change
us.
Your parents.
Let's take a little time, Zorba, to help out Joe in Jacksonville, Florida. Joe is suffering from hammer toes, and he would like to know if it's necessary to visit the doc or if switching to more comfortable shoes will do the trick.
Well, hammer toes, first of all, there's surgery for hammer toes. If you're bothered, the surgery is very useful. It does work. However, a lot of people can take care of hammer toes by changing their shoes. It mm-hmm. doesn't get rid of the hammer toe at all, but it gives more space in the shoebox. The shoebox is the end where our little feet are,
right.
little toes are, rather. And it's called the shoebox. You get a shoebox that is tall, and the hammer toe doesn't bother you as much. But there's no treatment for the hammer toe short of surgery, and
yeah.
so changing
so you,
the shoes.
You might as well do the shoe thing first and see if that
Well,
works.
That's what I would do.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't go for the surgery first. I would go for the shoe first to see whether or not that would make a difference. And for a lot of people, frankly, the shoe works and is very, very effective. Sometimes there also are little contraptions that you can buy, Dr. Scholl-type contractions, to try to straighten out this toe. I don't think they really do much good. So I would recommend the shoe as being the first step.
We'll try to hammer out answers to all of your health and lifestyle questions. Just send them along with your comments and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
You take care and stay well, Tom.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg, named after a village in Poland and doubles as our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music
Poland.
Is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0503Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.